So this is interviewing Radhakrishnan on 26th March 1972 on Borkfak.
Well, why don't we start by how you got involved in radio astronomy? You were trained in physics, really.
Isn't that true?
Training is the word.
Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose. It's right to say that I did do some physics at the university.
Which university?
University of Mysore. It was located at that time in Bangalore. Strange to relate, it's the place I'll be going back to. But what was the question again? How I got involved in radio astronomy?
In radio astronomy, right.
Is the level on that thing about right? Speaking of.
And that was in physics?
That was in physics, yes. But it had nothing to do with... I was interested in electronics and had always been. Since playing around with crystal sets and trying to radio receivers and transmitters together and so on. Electronic equipment that you can buy in India very, very cheaply at the war surplus. Stuff just flooded the markets. I remember being able to buy 3 centimeter klystrons for a few cents apiece.
Okay.
And 500 watt tubes for, everything sold for a few cents. This place was just flooded with all this junk that nobody had any use for. But I really got into radio astronomy only in, for the first time, only in Sweden.
Yeah, and how did you get to Sweden from India? That's not the obvious thing.
Well, I was just traveling around, seeing the world, so to speak, and I spent some time hitchhiking around Europe. And I ran out of money just about the time I got to Sweden, so I went to the Chalmers Institute of Technology, whose electronics laboratory of the Chalmers Institute was run by Professor Rydberg, whom I had run into years before when he was on a visit to India. And in fact, he had said in passing, in India, he had said, "Oh, why don't you come to Sweden sometime?" I said, "Do you mean it?" He said, "Yes." Little realizing that I would turn up this anyway. And so finally I got there and decided that I would stay and look around. So I asked for a job, and that wasn't easy to get because they didn't have any positions. So I offered to... I decided to stay, so I just offered to work for nothing at the Chalmers Institute for about 3 months. And I suggested that if they thought I was worth keeping after that, and they could, and if they decided I wasn't, then I promised to keep moving. And, well, that's what happened. Actually, I started by doing something in for Rydberg in his tube development laboratory. And he was working on a thing called the rototron, which is a frequency-multiplying device that used the following principle. If you took an ordinary electron gun, like you have in a cathode ray tube, something like that, and then you passed it through a pair of parallel plates, two pairs, and you fed them with signals which were in quadrature, so you could get this beam to go around in a circle, and just as you would do to get a circle on the screen, on the scope. Then you have an anode with a series of holes such that the electron beam in going through this plate would strike a hole and then strike the bit of metal in between and then the next hole and so on. And then you had another electrode beyond this which would catch the electrons that actually managed to get through the holes. So you'd get a number of impulses on that was equal to the number of holes times the rate at which it was
rotation
going around.
Rate, yes.
So this way you could multiply frequency, then you could have a very complicated arrangement of holes on the first anode such that by using a short radius, you could get a factor of 5, and on a slightly larger radius, you could get a factor of 6, 7, 8, 10, mm-hmm. 20, 100, whatever it is. So this would be one way of putting in a low frequency and getting out a higher frequency, which was precisely related to the input frequency.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether it was the need for frequency multipliers in radio astronomy receivers that prompted Rydberg to investigate this problem. But anyway, that's what I started doing.
Was it ever actually used to?
No, I don't think so. Like so many things, Chalmers Institute never really found its final use.
So, after this multiplier, what was your next venture there?
Well, before I say that, I just reminded of an interesting story, perhaps the only thing connected with this multiplier that remains vivid in my memory, is that it was in Sweden at the time I was working on this multiplier, which was the first month or two after getting there, that I really got drunk for the first time. We'd gone to some party or other, and the Swedes are very careful because they're traffic laws very, very strict, and if they're caught driving under the influence of drink, then they have their licenses taken away forever and ever and things like that. So I went along to this party. I was being driven by somebody else. Actually, I had enough car at that stage. I could hardly afford to eat properly. I was actually eating one meal a day in the students' mensa or equivalent.
Well, in fact, they put you up in the lab. Oh,
yeah, they gave me a room to sleep in the lab and a magnificent salary of $15 a month. And so all of the, there were several people at the party who kept emptying their drinks into my glass, some when I wasn't watching. And I was in the midst of a deep and philosophical discussion, and then I went into the gentleman's for something or other, and then woke up there. About 20 minutes later, sitting on the floor with my head over the jamb, I passed out. And so I was taken back to the lab to sleep it off, which I couldn't because I was sick all night. And I had the worst head ever, even including the experiences since then. I was terribly worried about this whole thing because the following morning, Rydberg was going to demonstrate his rototron to some very distinguished visitor from Stockholm, who was also influential in the funding business. And so Rydberg was always anxious to make the right kind of impression and so on. And we hardly got this thing working, but he was very, very anxious, and he'd asked me to make sure that everything would be right. This was the evening before the party, the afternoon before the party. And I got back from the party, or I was carried back, and I spent all night retching. And I just wasn't in a fit state the next morning to demonstrate any apparatus, the new or old type. But I was there. I don't think I was very coherent. I was in a terrible panic internally, because I thought Rydberg would notice that something was wrong. I just didn't want it to happen at that stage. And then I noticed that he steered the subject on to drink for some reason or other during this demonstration, and it was only much later that I discovered that he'd known all along about this incident, and he was just, you know, leaving me alone.
But did you get it demonstrated?
Oh yeah, professionally. Well, then what happened was that after about 3 months, I was offered the choice of working on the second floor or on the third floor, which meant either in the tube development department or in the radio astronomy department. I hadn't heard of radio astronomy at the time.
And what year is this now?
It was 1955. And so I said, what goes on in the third floor? And they said, radio astronomy. And I said, what's that? And they said, oh, it's a bloke who built a hydrogen line receiver, an early form of it, and it didn't work. It didn't work properly, or suddenly it was quite useless. And we were thinking of building a new receiver, would I be interested in chromium? So I said, what's a hydrogen line receiver? It was all explained to me that you had hydrogen vast quantities outside and this sent out some kind of radiation, you picked this up in a radio receiver and so on, and I said, sure, that sounds interesting, so I'll try it. And by that time they decided to employ me, pay me the right kind of salary and all the rest of it, give me an office.
Let me just ask, had there been any observations in Sweden before this time, or was it? You mentioned before to me that they had these
other frequencies. On other frequencies, they had several. As far as telescopes and receivers were concerned, there was a fairly well-equipped radioastronomical observatory. They had three Wurzburg telescopes, each of 25 feet in diameter. They had two large tiltable arrays and very fine meteor radar receiver. All sorts of things. It wasn't much astronomy, but there was certainly plenty of equipment around.
Did they do any astronomy? I mean, other than atmospheric stuff?
Don't really know. I'm sure nothing that mattered.
Yeah, I never heard of any of it.
So anyway, I took on this job of rebuilding, which was essentially starting from scratch, and that's what I did. I spent 3 years building this hydrogen line receiver, and I was joined by Höglund, whom I'm sure you've heard of, who's now running the observatory there, and Eldare.
Yeah, he's still there.
He's still there, he's done a lot of work on our age. In fact, I was back there the year before last. I was Eldare's examiner for his PhD thesis. It was interesting to catch up with old friends again.
And what about this hydrogen line receiver? I don't remember any hydrogen observations that were coming out of Sweden. Is that my ignorance?
No. But I think that's about the size of it. As far as I was concerned, I was just building the receiver, and it took that long because I literally had to learn what each little piece of the receiver did. I had no experience, whatever, but it was very interesting. I remember making a couple of trips to Holland, to Dwingeloo, to look at the marvelous machine that Muller had built.
Mm-hmm.
Read everybody's papers on their various instruments and so on. In fact, I think on one of my visits here, to Dwingeloo was on the day or the day after they had detected 21 centimeter emission from an external galaxy for the first time. And I remember some number like a 1 degree signal. I was amazed.
And was this the first time for anybody or just for the Dutch?
I'm not sure. The story, I'd have to think about this. You see, the only people that were interested in extragalactic 21 centimeter emission at that time was the Harvard group and the Dutch group. And an enormous number of papers were produced at Harvard, I think, all of which were later shown to be either faulty in some way or left much to be desired and so on. But I'm not sure whether.
Was it? Is that instrumental effects that were.
Yes, but you know, I'm not sure I should go into that really. Let's say that all of that work has been redone. Not everybody was happy with the results of the interpretation.
Okay. Well, I can check where the first external H1 was found.
Yes. As far as I remember, this was Andromeda, M31. And it might have been the first time.
Makes sense.
Anyway, I just, most of my time in Sweden up to 58, towards the end of 58, was taken up in, with this receiver and getting it better and better and so on. I wasn't particularly interested in observations. I wouldn't have known what to look at anyway. It was just that I didn't get around to, I was still
that phase of it, yeah.
Still playing with the receiver. and what happened next?
But did it ever do any observations?
I think it was used for some observations later.
After you left?
Right. Yeah. But don't forget that this receiver was stuck onto a 25-foot dish, which was getting to be pretty small.
When did the present non-sala dish come along?
Oh, many years later.
Okay.
Many years later. At least 5 or 6 years later. So that the angular resolution is very poor.
So they couldn't do much that couldn't be done at Kochbach already? That hadn't been done?
No, but there were any number of hydrogen line problems that hadn't been attacked by then. I think there are still many problems that haven't been attacked. Lindblad, who was...
Which one?
The older Lindblad. The big one. He was very interested in observations towards the anti-center, because they're tied up with his model for galaxies and so on, which is, as you know, is tied up with the present the density wave business.
Mm-hmm.
And also popular. And I think he was trying to persuade Rydbeck to do some observations.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some were done, but this was after I left.
But in fact, his son has continued this anti-center interest.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yes. But nothing really important came out of that.
Okay, well, so then you went to Caltech.
Yeah, there's a little story, a connection that's probably worth telling. I decided to go to the United States just because I wanted to see the United States, in the same way that I went to Sweden not to build hydrogen line receivers, just because I wanted to go to Sweden. And I was looking around for a job, and I asked somebody how much money you need to live, and I was told that graduate students live on $2,000 a year or some such thing. So then I wondered if anybody would pay me $2,000 a year. And so I was sort of looking around for a job, and then Rydbeck said, leave it to me, I'm going to the United States, I'll get you a job over there. And I said, oh, well, it's okay with me if you want to do that. And he said, I don't think you should go to the East Coast, the West Coast is the place for you. There's a man called John Bolton there who's just built a new observatory with two big dishes which can be used as an interferometer. And I said, okay. And the story, apparently, I've had this confirmed from both sides, that Rydbeck was on the East Coast, and he telephoned John Bolton, who was an old friend of his. John was on the West Coast, so he called him up on the telephone and said, I have someone working at my lab who wants to come to the United States, and I think you should hire him. And John Bolton said, asked who it was. And Rydbeck said, it's an Indian. John Bolton said, no, thank you, I've had one already.
He had his token Indian.
He'd had an Indian, apparently. Hadn't enjoyed the experience. Apparently, Rydbeck said, well, this one's slightly different, why don't you try him? He said, are you sure? And Rydbeck said, yes, I'm sure. So the next thing I knew, I was offered a job in California. And then when they sent me their letter of appointment or whatever it was, I found that I was going to be paid $5,250. So I wrote to Bolton in a panic, saying there must be some mistake. He misunderstood my qualifications, I'm sure. There must be some mistake, and I couldn't possibly do anything to justify that amount of money. So I got a curt letter from John saying, why don't you leave that to me and just do what you have to do. So that's how I ended up at Caltech. Except that another little incident which might be of interest, in the actual process of getting to Caltech, I was driving across the United States. I bought myself a Volkswagen in Europe, which I was taking to California because I was told that was a good way to do things and they were more expensive there. This way I could drive across and see the country. So I happened to drive through Greenbank.
Mm-hmm.
And there I met somebody who was This was in the early days of grain bank. It hadn't got going.
What year is this now?
This is 58.
Oh, 58. Yeah.
And there were just a few people
just
there.
Just clearing the land then.
Yeah. Well, no. Gone further, they had their 85-foot ditch. And Hayne Butzel, with whom I'd worked in Sweden,
mm-hmm.
had gone over to grain bank just about then. And I think the only other people at that time that I can remember were John Finlay, Dave Heach, and Frank Drake. And that was the,
that was about it, yeah.
The beginnings. But I met this other gentleman who was tinkering around with some very old type radio tubes on some of the most ancient looking holders for these tubes, and these wires fastened by means of little nuts and things like that, the way they used to be. I mean, it looked like some little antique thing. He was very involved in this. He was playing around. I was introduced to him, but I didn't catch the name, which I should have. And then he asked me what I was doing and where I was going, and I said I was going to Caltech, the Owensbury Observatory. And he said, I'll tell you how to get there. So he drew me a map. I started, you know, which way I should go through Nevada and where I should get out. Through Death Valley and so on and so on. That was my first meeting with Groot Reber.
Uh-huh. Was he actually employed there at that time?
No, but...
Well, he
might have been, in the sense Groot Reber is never employed anywhere. The Research Corporation of America supports him, but he honors various places by spending some time. Now, Groot Reber is someone that you should really...
Oh, yeah. Try to spend a while with him. What is this about RCA, though? I mean, they support
not RCA. Research Corporation
of America.
That's not RCA.
No. What is it?
That is a little organization which has money left to it by, I don't know, some donor or other. Or maybe they have money invested somewhere. But they select, they pick out a few individuals to whom they give money to do research.
The old inventor school,
right.
Sort of thing.
No questions asked.
So they
Groot Reber has been supported by this corporation for years and years.
I see.
Enables him to go to Tasmania or Antarctica or wherever he places him to do whatever he likes, whether it's growing beans, you know, which color are anti-clockwise, clockwise, or...
No, I haven't heard of that. Okay, so out to Caltech in 58, and you say the first two Owens Valley dishes had just been built. At that time?
Yes. One of them had just been connected up, so it was being used as a single dish. And the other one had been constructed. It wasn't in operation.
These are the present day 90 footers.
Right. No, they've been resurfaced now.
Yeah. Right. And what
that was almost at the very beginning. Actually, Caltech, the very first dish was a 30-foot homemade dish, which was originally installed on Palomar Mountain, believe it or not.
Oh, never heard of that.
Yeah.
Who did that?
Well, John Bolton and Gordon Stanley. Well, this is in a belt of our own hands, sort of thing. And that was used for hydrogen line observations. I think they were done in two halves. Bolton and Harris, I think, did one half, and that was published straight away, and Tom Matthews did the other half, and I think that bit never got published.
Where was the Bolton in
PASP.
Huh. Very interesting. And galactic structure? What did I mean?
Yeah.
I have to look that up, yeah. So,
and that dish got moved over to Owens Valley later. I think by the time I got there, it had just been moved.
So what were these dishes at Caltech first used for? What was the purpose, so to speak, of their
main... Well, they were intended to be used as an interferometer, sort of high-frequency interferometer. They were intended to do all the marvelous things, which in fact they did afterwards. By the time I went there, one of the dishes was being used, as I say, just by itself on 960 megacycles, and Harris and Roberts had done survey of, well, they'd gone through the 3C catalog, I think, to see how many sources they could see at high frequencies, and that was very important at that time.
You knew nothing about the spectrum.
Right. Right.
Is this Dan Harris and Mort Roberts?
No. Jim Roberts.
Okay.
Jim Roberts, and so there was a very important paper, I think, which is a list of sources with their fluxes near 1,000 megs and their spectra and so on. And then there were some observations on planets. I think Jim Roberts had looked at Jupiter and found that it was giving off much more radiation than one expected it would at that high frequency, and that was about the same time that Drake and Watson did the same sort of thing at Green Bank in the 85 foot dish.
This Jim Roberts, I don't know him. Where is he now?
In Australia. You should know of him.
Really?
Oh, he's done a great many things. He's one of the early...
At Parkes? I mean, is he at CSIRO now?
Yeah. Well, even before at Caltech, and then at Parkes. In fact, one of the earliest articles that I have seen on radio astronomy published in Nature was written by Jim Roberts.
And what was this about?
No, it's just radio astronomy in general.
Oh, when was this? I'd be interested.
Oh, I don't know, in the middle 50s, I should imagine. He was a student of Fred Hoyle's at Cambridge.
And where? Oh, you said now he's at CSIRO. Yeah. I'm afraid that's a gap in my knowledge. So, what did you first work on at Caltech?
Oh, rebuilt the hydrogen line receiver.
Use your expertise.
In fact, that's what I was hired for. You see, I wasn't hired to do any astronomy at all. I was hired to... I was really hired to fix the receiver.
Uh-huh.
Having fixed the... Well, I think the first... It's hard to remember in which order they came, but I spent most of my time playing with the hydrogen ion receiver for a start, and the first work that was done with the hydrogen ion receiver was detection of absorption in a number of new sources with John Bolton. He was the one who really got me on first order.
Mm-hmm.
Which, in a way, I've been working on ever since.
Yeah.
That's getting on 14 years now.
In your theme, more or less.
Yeah, I hope. And anyway, that's when it all started.
Can I ask a question while I think of it about hydrogen absorption?
Yeah.
The NRL, McLean and Company, were the first to detect
hydrogen
absorption.
Right.
But there was a misunderstanding as to what absorption was.
The very first paper is by Hagen and McLean.
Right. Short little paper.
Very short note. Reading that, it was clear that, it's quite clear that they didn't know what was happening. They discovered a sort of negative going signal.
They thought the hydrogen was behind the source.
That's right. They thought the source was obscuring the emission from the hydrogen. And the story that then there was a second paper, which was published by Hagen
with Lilly.
Yeah,
and that put the correct equation of transfer and so forth in.
Right, but...
I never did see McLean about this. I meant to before I left Washington.
Yeah.
But then you were going to say there's a second...
Well, I think... I don't know if you're doing the right thing into digging into this kind of history. I can't remember where I got the story from, but I have always believed that it was George Field who really put them onto this, and I think who was also instrumental in explaining some of this.
Even to Lilly. I thought Lilly was a Harvard physicist and all that.
Oh. I'm sure George Field had something to do with it.